Rich, you've written two books so far about terrorism. One is a kind of chronicle of what happened under Clinton's presidency, and the other one is the first 4 years of George Bush. And you say in this last book of your Shadow War, your thesis is that America is winning the war on terror. For Europeans, this is something which they don't believe, actually, but try to convince us. Is America winning the war on terror?
Well, I'd like to hear your argument that we're not. I think that on balance, we are winning. I think this for several kinds of reasons. One, since 9/11, more than 5,000 al-Qaeda have been killed or captured in 102 different countries. The war on terror is a lot larger than the war in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and in fact, it occurs on a global stage.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a tremendous number of terrorist plots by al-Qaeda and its allied organizations against Western targets, American, Australian, our allies in Asia, and of course in Europe, that have been thwarted. I'll give you a brief list of some of those thwarted attacks.
Mm-hmm.
You have the attempted bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Paris by al-Qaeda. That plot was stopped. The attempt to sink U.S. warships and British warships in the Straits of Gibraltar. That by ramming the Zodiac inflatable rafts loaded with bombs into the hulls of those ships. That plot was stopped. In fact, the intelligence that led to the unraveling of that plot came from prisoners held in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
That alone, I think, justifies the holding mm-hmm. of those prisoners, but we can get to that.
Now, some people say that actually we've just seen last week the bombings in London, that we've called this upon ourselves by the invasion of Iraq, and that actually we've been, that terrorism is worse now, or the threat of terrorism is worse than before. Is that true?
I don't think it is. I have a minority contrarian view, but here it is. If you look at the death toll on 9/11, this is the attacks on mm-hmm. New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania, more than 3,000 people perished. If you look at the attacks in Bali, where 202 people died, and in Madrid on March 11, 2004, where you had about 197 people, I believe, died. That's one order of magnitude less than those who died on 9/11. The death toll as of today in London is 53. That's mm-hmm. a second order of magnitude less than 9/11. If anything, the lethality of al-Qaeda is decreasing over time. Its ability to carry out large, complicated operations where they need perfect surprise in order to succeed and perfect coordination in order to have mass casualties. They simply don't have the ability. With the exception of the bombings in 2003 in Turkey, no al-Qaeda cell has been able to strike twice in quick succession in the same country. That American, European, and allied governments have been very effective at breaking up these cells. As for this idea that Iraq has brought terrorism onto Europe and onto America, first of all, 9/11 occurred before the Iraq War, mm-hmm. several years before. But also, let's remember what happened in the 1990s. We had a series of attacks on American, British, and French interests from al-Qaeda from 1992 onwards. One of those attacks, August 7th, 1998, two U.S. embassies were hit, one in Kenya, the other in Tanzania,
mm-hmm.
Killing hundreds of people, mostly Muslim Africans, so people tend to forget their lives lost. But that certainly wasn't brought on by the Iraq War. The attack, the November 7th, 1995 attack at Riyadh, which killed five Americans and two Indian nationals and an unknown number of Saudis, that wasn't brought on by Iraq. The attack on U.S. forces in Somalia, which we now know was organized by elements of al-Qaeda, October 3rd and 4th, 1993, that wasn't brought on by Iraq. The 1993 World Trade Center bombing, which killed seven people. Mm-hmm. I say seven, most accounts say six, because I count the unborn son of Monica Smith.
Yeah.
That wasn't brought on by Iraq. The attack on the USS Cole in October 2000, which mm-hmm. cost the lives, I believe, of 44 U.S. sailors, either killed or injured, that wasn't brought on by Iraq. The attempt to destroy the Eiffel Tower by driving a plane into it in 1994, Algerian militants, that wasn't brought on by Iraq. The attempt to kill the Pope in the Philippines in 1994, that was not brought on by
but
Iraq.
But people will say, well, we've exacerbated the feelings of hostility in the Muslim world against the West by invading Iraq and by kind of anti-Muslim attitudes. Do you share this opinion?
I don't know if I share it or not, because I'd have to ask some questions first, such as, how do they measure the public opinion in Muslim lands, when these are all but one, Iraq, all of them are dictatorships in which public
opinion... Yeah, but they mean Muslim populations in Western Europe.
Okay, fine. Those are not dictatorships, just socialist bastard cases.
Yeah.
However, this is just simply asserted. There's never been a series of scientific polls which has measured Muslim public opinion in Europe over time using the same methods.
Mm-hmm.
This is simply asserted into existence. It's not proven. So I don't know whether to believe the statement or disbelieve it, because I don't think there's enough evidence one way or the other to know for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And what's amazing to me is these people make these charges without feeling the obligation to bring forward some kind of evidence that Muslim public opinion in Europe or America or anywhere has changed.
Mm-hmm.
How do they know? How can they possibly know?
Mm-hmm. Some people say there's a threat that if we go or if our state security service are going to control the Muslim population, then actually our civic liberties will have to be limited or restricted. And there was an article on the website, I think, or on the New York Sun of Daniel Pipes, who actually says that France is doing a better job in fighting terrorism than Britain, because the British allow too much civic liberties to Muslim groups, and they don't go after the Muslims as the French do. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't agree with Daniel Pipes on everything, but I think it's fairly well established that the French have the most restrictive counterterrorism policies in Europe and perhaps in the industrialized world.
Yeah, and do you think that helps? That's a good thing to have these restrictive policies?
I don't know if it... There's two questions here. One, does it work? And two, is it morally justified?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it works. Certainly the French have stopped a great number of plots, and France has not seen a widespread attack like Madrid, like London, mm-hmm. like New York. So is it because they're very good, or is it because they're lucky? I don't know. I don't know. It might be possible to know that, but I don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
However, France is a wonderful case for those who say we have to diminish civil liberties in order to crack down on terrorism. France has the most restrictive and perhaps the most effective counterterrorism policy, and yet France is still, by and large, a free country.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest threat journalists face is not censorship by the government, but lawsuits by interested parties who don't like what they have to say.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, of course, a problem in this country, Belgium, and in other European countries. But that's unrelated to the counterterrorism mm-hmm. policies. I mean, I think France could do with a far freer economy and all these sorts of things, which you and I have talked about many times. But if Britain and America and other countries, Germany, for example, were to pursue a more aggressive counterterrorism strategy, it would probably look a lot like France, which is not a nightmare scenario. France, for better or for worse, mm-hmm. it's not Nazi Germany, it's not Egypt, it's not Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. it is not Poland in 1985. Mm-hmm. It is a state with a strong instinct for the survival of its people. And so far, it seems to be pretty effective.
Now, you're working on a third book, and unlike these other two that you've done, you're focusing now on disinformation. And by this, I think you mean the way in which the Western press writes about terrorism, and in a way you say that we are actually, our media are actually playing the same or helping the terrorists in a certain way.
I think that's overstating my case a little bit. I don't think that the media are actively helping, with a few exceptions, the terrorists. However, they've created this environment of poisonous skepticism, where they raise questions about things in which the truth is very quickly and easily known, and it is the opposite of the things that they say. A few quick examples. Newsweek ran with a story about the flushing of a Quran down the toilet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What they didn't do is a little bit of basic reporting. They didn't care enough about facts. Here's the questions they didn't ask. How many Qurans were distributed by the U.S. military to prisoners in Bagram and Guantanamo and elsewhere?
Mm-hmm.
How many were distributed? How many do they have now? Are any missing? Point one.
Mm-hmm.
Point two, what are the dimensions of those Qurans? The Qurans that are handed out are pocket-sized Qurans, about this size, about this wide, mm-hmm. about this tall, and about this thick. All right, why do we want to know the dimensions? Because now we're going to see if it is physically possible to flush it down the toilet. In fact, the toilets they use are not flush toilets, they're chemical toilets, so they could not have been flushed. But second of all, even if it was put in the toilet, it wouldn't have gone down because the access pipe is this size and the Quran is this size. There's no geometrical way in which to place it for it to go down. So this is a story where, okay, you get this. You get the source gives you the information. You, have a journalist, have an obligation to check out the facts that are knowable, and see, is this possible?
Yeah, but this is just sloppy journalism, and we had that also during the Cold War. So actually, it's the same. It's the same phenomenon. It or is different nowadays, and it's not just a news story. But give us some other examples of disinformation.
Well, and a classic example is that Bin Laden is on dialysis. This was disinformation put out by the Pakistani Intelligence Service in late 1998. They were getting a lot of pressure from the Clinton administration and to a certain extent from the British government for them to turn over Bin Laden for the attacks on the embassies in Africa. And the Taliban was a government that was set up by the Pakistanis. In fact, if you talk to Pakistani government officials, they will very rarely refer to the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Instead, they will recur to the Durant Line. They consider Afghanistan to be an extension of theirs. And as a result, they set up the Taliban in order to control that territory that was created and funded by ISI. They did not want Bin Laden to be turned over because he would reveal the degree of collusion between the Taliban, Bin Laden, and the Pakistanis themselves. Secondly, they had future uses for him. So what they did is they took, they were very shrewd and sharp at how they read the Clinton administration. And they figured out that if we give the Clinton administration a plausible enough excuse not to act, they will not act. And that's what they did. They said, well, he's on dialysis, he'll probably die anyway. Now, this myth has continued long after 9/11 in the absence of any evidence, and in fact, lots of evidence to the contrary. For example, Bin Laden's personal doctor was captured in Pakistan and held in U.S. custody for more than 3 months. After he was released, he gave a number of interviews, not just the Pakistani press, but the English-language Pakistani press, to a newspaper called Dawn. I believe he also spoke to another newspaper called The Nation.
And when was that?
In 2003. And he immediately said that he did not, Bin Laden did not have, he had a bad back, he had dehydration, he had other health problems. But he certainly was not on dialysis and had no kidney problems. Bin Laden himself has said on the record that he has no health problems at all to a Pakistani journalist named Hamid Mir in November 2001. Doctors and intelligence agents with medical backgrounds who studied Bin Laden and his tapes point out that people are on dialysis for years. You get a discoloration of the skin. You get certain telltale features and signs, none of which Bin Laden displays.
So, and you're going to Afghanistan next week. Do you think that that Bin Laden, that Afghanistan is a place where Bin Laden is still hanging around nowadays?
I don't know, but it's certainly possible. The Pakistanis all say that he's in Afghanistan. The Afghans say that he's in Pakistan or Iran. Certainly the Afghans have a reason to turn him over. The Karzai government is continuing to be destabilized by elements of Al-Qaeda and by the Taliban. I mean, to this day, there are major fighting in the Paktia province and some of the other eastern or southeastern provinces along the Pakistan border. And I don't think there's been enough skepticism of Pakistan's role in the war on terror. I mean, on the other hand, in one sense, they've done a lot. More than 700 Al-Qaeda since 9/11 have been captured in Pakistan, more than any other nation, including Iraq or Afghanistan.
Well, Pakistan isn't on the list of the rogue states of the United States, so they consider it an ally, in a way.
It is an ally, but it's a very two-sided ally. I mean, it's like the Cold War. The critical moments in the war on terror are not black and white, but gray. And you have to choose your enemies and choose your allies. And sometimes you're choosing from the same pool. On the other hand, we should be, I think, far more critical, not just of the human rights record of the Pakistanis, but their general behavior and outlook.
Yeah. Maybe one final question that takes us to another ally or a traditional ally of the United States, that's Saudi Arabia. Mm. Now, there were recent comments in the press, I think this week, where people are saying that lots of, or maybe a group of rich Saudis actually funding Al-Qaeda. So this seems to be an ally which isn't really an ally. So what do you think about the Saudi position regarding the fight against Al-Qaeda?
Well, you should really ask my friend James Toronto. He's got this fabulous phrase, our friends the Saudis, yeah, which captures it exactly. They're technically our friends, but the more that phrase repeats in his Best of the Web column, the more you chuckle, because it's... I think the Saudis, individual Saudis, have... I don't think the state has sponsored Al-Qaeda since 9/11. Individual sheikhs and princes have continued to fund.
Yeah, if the state knows this, they can crack down on them, and then it can try to stop the funding of Al-Qaeda.
Well, let's step back and understand a little bit about Saudi Arabia. I'm not making excuses for them, but I'm just saying if we're going to criticize them, let's do it in a very informed way. Saudi Arabia is run by two clouds of people. And I say clouds because they're very loosely affiliated, yet they all matter. There are the clerics, about 4,000 of them, and the princes, about 4,000 of them.
Yeah.
And for anything to get done, you need unanimity or near unanimity with these two groups of people. And any kind of crackdown threatens not just that consensus, but the legitimacy of the state. What Saudi Arabia has to offer the residents of Arabia is order.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically, they provide very little in terms of welfare, in terms of schooling. There are still, I think, less than 100 hospitals in the country, very few universities, very few educational opportunities, despite the immense oil wealth. More than a third of the world's proven oil reserves are in Saudi Arabia, but the per capita income, when you take away the money that's made for the princes...
Well, they use the money to fund fundamentalist mosques in Europe.
Yes. Well, but of course, the European governments are complicit in that.
Yeah.
If Europe was serious about counterterrorism, what it would do is say that no religious institution, church, mosque, synagogue, whatever, can receive funding from outside the country. And it would further stipulate that the congregation must provide at least half of the funds before the state could provide any funds. Now, more radical view, I don't think the state should finance religion at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's ultimately bad for religion as well as bad for the state. I think the promotion of religion is healthy for a state because something beyond economic self-interest has to hold a country together. There has to be something higher, something intangible, mystical, metaphysical, but nonetheless present and real. And religion has traditionally, in every society known to man, provided some of that connecting tissue that makes a group of people into a nation and a nation into a country. And when you finance religion, you necessarily change it and warp it to serve the politicians.
Yeah, but it aren't the Western... Well, in Western Europe, it's the state that finances religion, but in the United States, for instance, it's not. So in the United States, if you're an American and you are a Muslim and you have a mosque, you can ask a Saudi princes for subsidy.
Yeah, I think there has to be some restrictions. I think that the money should not be able to come from abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that would be a problem. If you extend this rule to the Catholics, I don't think it would be a problem because I think you'd discover, certainly in Belgium, but in most European countries, the church money goes to Rome. It doesn't come from Rome. So I don't think it would be...
Yeah.
Applying that rule would not have... Yeah. I mean, I'd have to look at the details, but I don't think it would have deleterious effects. But you have to stop the overseas funding. And if you let most of the Muslims, I'm prepared to believe, are moderate in that they left a fundamental... If they wanted to be fundamentalists, they have far more opportunity and scope to do that in their home countries. They're interested in economic opportunity, which means in some small way they're interested in changing.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they think they're going to change in small ways in terms of improving their economic outlook and improving their education. But in the course of doing those two things, things about you change. And I think Europe has to think about how it wants to make these people assimilate, because they must be made to assimilate or they will become a mortal threat to the societies over time. When I want to frighten Belgians, I say, who is going to pay your Social Security when the average Belgian prays five times a day?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.